Welcome to the Azure Podcast, a series of short discussions on various topics related to the Microsoft Cloud Platform. Your hosts, Kale Teeta, Evan Basilek, Russell Young, and Sujeet DeMello discuss a specific topic on each show to give you a high-level overview of that topic and resources to get more information, should you wish to dig further. For more information on our show, please see our website at azpodcast.com. Welcome back to the Azure Podcast. This is episode number 221, being recorded on the 21st of March, 2018, with special guest Andrew Liu. I'm Sujeet, and on Skype with me, I have Kale, Cynthia, Russell, and of course our special guest, Andrew. I think Evan's still moving houses, I believe, so he may not be with us today. And I know Kendall is away for a long vacation, so we've got the rest of the crew here. And as usual, let's get started with some of the updates, recent updates. And thanks, guys. I know Russell and Kale put a lot of links in the show notes. Kale, I see the blockchain one in there after a long break.
Of course, man.
How'd you manage to slip that in there? Okay, what's up with blockchain these days?
A couple things, but the stuff we're talking about right now is the multi-member blockchain networks has been kind of enhanced a little bit. So, you know, those who have used our offerings up there know that we have a lot of stuff kind of for infrastructure automation, you know, to spin these complex networks up and, you know, basically refining that a bit more, adding things like VM scale sets and managed disks and, you know, all the kind of normal stuff that you would expect has kind of evolved as the platform evolved. There's also a lot of new stuff for around monitoring and operational support. So being able to actually kind of start to peer into the network a little bit and understand a little bit of telemetry coming out of there. Again, that's going to get even further enhanced, but this is the first kind of stage of that. We also published some guides around multi-member networks and doing the different regions. So more complex kind of engagements coming out from customers now. So if you have a second, you should take a look, both the stuff in the portal, but also there's a lot of documentation around how to kind of manage these larger networks now.
Wow, that's good. So they're kind of making it more enterprise ready, it seems, right? Getting it ready.
Yep.
Good. Excellent. Well, Russell, I know you put a bunch of links in there. Which one do you like to talk about?
So there's a couple of really good, interesting database ones, really. So these are both GA announcements. So they've been in public preview for a little while. But the first one is the GA of the Azure Database Services for MySQL and Postgres. So they're out there now for people to use. There's quite a lot of excitement around that. The other one is column store support in standard tier on Azure SQL databases. So this is for applications that run queries across, you know, millions of rows, but they need to be more efficient in the way they aggregate. So the way the data is structured on disk will be column-based instead of row-based. So it allows you to go through all those rows in a lot more efficient way. So that's quite a nice feature that's gone in there, and it's, like I say, standard tier now.
Awesome. I know Evan would have loved to have talked about those things if he were here.
But yeah.
We're going to have to fill in for him. You know, the one that I liked was Azure Traffic Manager. We haven't talked about that in a while, but it's got this neat feature now called Traffic View. It kind of, you know, gives you like this worldwide view about where traffic is coming from, where the hotspots are, you know, where you should be worrying about maybe deploying to additional regions and things like that. So, thought it was a nice enhancement in there, just to give you a global perspective of where your audience is.
Yeah, that's pretty neat. Just one thing to kind of, it's a bit more of a plug really, but it's a great resource that's out there now. There's a guy in the UK called Azure Dan that some people might have heard of because he does a lot of sort of video blogging, lots of resources and stuff like that. We've had him on the show, in fact, in the past as well. So he's done this thing called Build a Company in a Day in Azure, and it's all about how you can go from nothing to running the standard kind of services that any business might want using Azure infrastructure and platform services to do it. So he's been delivering this as a session where he'll spend a day with a set of customers presenting and letting people actually hack and do the stuff and reproduce it for themselves as well and work on it to get hands-on experience. But what he's done now is actually record it. So he's spent a good long time in his recording studio at home, just producing videos around how he does all this stuff. And he's made that available now on YouTube. So it takes you right from, you know, how to navigate the portal, use the command line shell, put some virtual networks together, some VMs using Linux and Windows and Linux, a little bit on containers and DevOps and orchestration, going right through to Azure AD, how to use AD Connect, building web apps, logic apps, bots, cognitive services, and all this kind of stuff. So it's a really in-depth video. If you go to the YouTube link, there's a whole load of section links in there as well, so you don't have to watch the whole thing. If you want to skip the intro bits and you're more focused on, say, security features of Azure Security Central, privileged identity management, you can go straight to those bits if you like. But it's well worth a view, so we'll put the link in the show notes as well, and you can get it from the Azure Citadel that we talked about last time as well.
I'm going to have to, Dan, I know Dan very well, I'm sure you guys do as well, and I'm going to have to get on him about his acronyms. That's a terrible acronym. You need to bring your own company. That's what he should be doing, you know?
Why, instead of build a company, yeah.
It's Bastion? I don't know what that is.
We've been talking about doing a builder school in a day as well for sort of the education section, but yeah. Nice.
Kale, go ahead, Dan.
Yeah, the one other one that sticks out at me is real quick is the general availability of Postgres. You know, the Postgres SQL. So that's awesome. That was, just, I think, yesterday, the 20th. They announced that was in GA. So Postgres is a service and MySQL is a service. These are awesome.
And it's nice that it's fully managed services, right? So it's not just, running or spinning up a VM and all that.
Yeah, totally. I mean, before we rely on Docker and having to run another VM and stuff like that. So this is super awesome.
Yep. Of course, you know, I mean, you guys recall I've always been a fan of Service Fabric, and, you know, this recent news has been quite exciting where they're moving Service Fabric to the open source. Now, Service Fabric is something that, you know, obviously Microsoft uses in Azure under the covers, there is a lot of code involved, but they have had this Linux version of Service Fabric that they have worked on recently, and so that's the first thing that's been pushed to the open source, and they're working on getting the Windows version, which is obviously much larger because it just, you know, they built so many tools around it. So they're working on putting that up, and that might take a little while. But I think it's nice to see them put that out there. I think people, it's quite obvious that customers want to see stuff in the open source so they can review the code and ensure that it has all the right, you know, security aspects built in and things like that. So That's exciting news for Service Fabric.
One more from me, if that's all right. So Azure Alerts, in the portal in the past, we've got various different places where you can go and get resource monitors, alerts triggered, look at events, look at log analytics searches, and so on and so forth. That has all been now put through this kind of a new generation on Azure Alerts. So there's a unified experience for it now. So that's been in public preview for a little while. There's been some really good feedback from our customers that have been using that. So it's one place you can go and get access to all your alerts and log stuff. So it's quite a nice way of improving the overall experience for that.
Cool. Right. Well, those were quite a few updates. I think it's a good time to take a break here, and let's turn the mic over to our special guest. Andrew, please introduce yourself to our listeners and let us know what you've been working on recently.
Hey. My name is Andrew Liu. I work in a product management capacity for Azure Cosmos DB. One of the recent features we've been working on is our Graph API, in which we expose the ability to do graph traversals with the Gremlin query language. We'd really love to share all about the goodness around graphs, because graphs are everywhere.
That's true, yeah. I mean, I think as a developer, you know, the graph seems like a new concept, but yet it seems like it's really all around us, right? With Active Directory graphs and things like that. So, how should a developer even start looking at a graph-based system? Like, what should they be thinking about? Just, hey, you know, I need to use something like a Graph API or a Graph DB.
So, I mean, at a very, very high level, a graph is merely a set of what we call vertices and edges. And you can think of vertices as a set of objects and edges as annotated relationships between those vertices. It's an interesting way of setting up these relationships. So rather than, you know, a more traditional way of where you would form a cross product based off of a reference stored in a column, what you're doing here is you're actually setting up direct links between a particular object and a particular, you know, another object. A neat thing about this is this opens the door for really large-scale graphs where you want to do many, many hops. I think the most intuitive use case for most people coming in is doing things like social network analysis, like doing the 6 degrees of Kevin Bacon kind of queries. But from here, what you slowly understand is graphs are actually everywhere. So for example, within Azure, we actually use our Cosmos DB Graph API to do things like dependency management between our individual servers, our services, and our customers running on those particular servers and services. And so that way, when we have, let's say, an incident, we actually have an exact idea of who our impacted customers are and who we need to reach out to make sure that everything is all good. We use it also all around Microsoft. I mean, we have a supply chain in which Microsoft itself manufactures devices. And so how do we actually navigate this relationship between parts for a device, the actual devices themselves, the manufacturing plants, the shipments going out, the returns coming in, our sales going out? And so when we scan, let's say, a return device coming in, we actually want to know everything about it. We want to be able to traverse and go like, you know what, if we were to go from this device being scanned in, let's actually track these components down. What was the defective component? From here, out of all of those components, what are the other devices that that manufacturing plant has touched? And where are they now? Like, where have we actually gone out and distributed those devices? And so doing these multiple traversals, these hops between many different kind of relationships and many different kinds of objects, this is really the power of graph.
One of the scenarios I've come across recently that really kind of brought home how it can apply to the real world as well is when you're thinking about geography. And there's an example in one of the books I've been reading on graph. There's it's about airports, basically. So you've got airport that's linked to another airport by the fact there's a direct flight there. And the way in which you can traverse the graph to go from one country to another, you know, and you can query easily how many countries are two hops away from another one and so on and so forth. And if you annotate the route with the distance as well, or the time that it takes to do that flight, then you get all that kind of information as well. It's, and that kind of makes it quite real if you're new to this, because I've always done SQL and relational databases before. So to kind of reimagine things in graph is quite a sort of a mind step change.
Oh, yeah. And funny you bring that up. We're actually working with a number of different transportation companies as well as airlines on this exact use case, doing things like, you know what, I don't want to just look at direct flights between a source and a destination, but I actually want to get an idea of, you know, what if I extend like an intermediate node or, you know, two nodes in between, what might that path look like? And of course, I mean, there's always the canonical example, which is doing social network analysis. We have seen people do even our own first-party services like Skype. We're working with them on building like a recommendation system for finding which contacts should we be adding for you on Skype. So, I mean, graph has been an interesting evolving space. A lot of this it's a fairly young space, and I mean, a few things to know about graph. Like we throw around terms like Tinkerpop and Gremlin. It'd actually be good to like kind of demystify what these things are. And at a high level, I mean, when graphs are young, and really we're not that distant from it. Every graph database vendor was actually coming up with like novel query languages and novel protocols for how they want to represent a graph as well as traverse the graph. And so we took this approach of trying to look for an open source standard. And what we found was not too long ago, the Apache Foundation also discovered this problem of it's basically like the Wild West, and you have like a dozen proprietary languages. And so they actually brought in this project called Apache Tinkerpop. And the high-level goal here is they wanted to establish a protocol. So you can think of like something like ODBC is for relational databases. Tinkerpop is that for graph databases. And then furthermore, the Gremlin Quirly language, you can think of what SQL is to relational databases, Gremlin is to graph databases. And so starting off, we wanted to take a standards-based approach for attaching to the open source ecosystem and making sure that we meet our developers where they are, as opposed to forcing them to, you know, learn yet another set of concepts. And so when you see people name drop things like Tinkerpop and Gremlin, like this is really what it means is this is more of an open source standards based approach to building a set of protocol and query languages.
Okay. That actually did put me off a little bit when I first got exposed to Cosmos DB and going through it. I was looking at those things. I was going, I'm never gonna pick all this stuff up with all these funny names. But it shouldn't put people off because actually it's quite straightforward. And there's a lot of tutorials out there. Gremlin particularly. There's a lot of good resources to go and get going with that. And once you play with it, I think it's fairly intuitive. And it's not like SQL, but you can get used to it fairly quickly. And it seems incredibly powerful as well.
Yeah, and the simple structure of a Gremlin query. You can think of is this notation of starting with a graph, find me all the vertices, find me all the objects that have this property meeting this filter. Like let's find all of the users whose age is between, I don't know, 22 and 30. And from there, let's take a look at those relationships, those outbound edges, and look at something like, you know what, out of all of these guys, find all of their relationships of type interest, and look at those interests. And out of those interests, let's say that interest is a set of sports like football and basketball and a set of sports teams. Out of those, find me all of the other folks who are interested in the same subjects. And then out of that, I want to now do another traversal and look at the outbound edges of what kind of devices are they using? Are they, you know, OS X users? Are they Windows users? And so what you can do is you can mix and match different types of objects and different types of relationships. And what the query language is if you were to translate it into like human form, you're just chaining a bunch of commands saying like, find me these kind of objects, and from here, filter, apply this filter, and then chain this kind of relationship, and you're just chaining relationships over and over until you meet your criteria. And then you can then do some more sophisticated things like tagging the vertices along the edge, and that way if you want to go like, you know what, now out of all of these filters, find me the source vertices such that I find like who are my influential people that I want to target, let's say for talking and spreading some, you know, social media love. So you can do a lot of very powerful things. But at the end of the day, like when you actually look at the query language, it's quite intuitive. It's just a chaining a sequence of commands.
So you say that about mixing and matching vertices or nodes or objects or whatever you want to call them. Is that because it's basically NoSQL under the covers?
So one of the neat things about Cosmos DB is it's a truly schema-free database. And so as you ingest different objects of different types, one of the unique capabilities that we built was this automatic indexing. What we do is we basically build this concept of an inverted index. There's a bunch of documentation. I won't go too into what an inverted index is. But the high-level neat thing about it is it gives you a way of automatically indexing every property of every record without knowing the schema up front, so you don't have to do anything like create index or drop index as you introduce new different properties for different objects. And this gives you a very, very flexible way of then combining a very diverse set of objects into Cosmos DB and then running graph traversals using our graph query engine on top of a fully indexed data store so that you can then pivot off of all sorts of different attributes.
That's really interesting. I was going to ask about indexing because I've seen that some of the other implementations of graph, they need to be told what indexes you want to be created. But yeah. Cosmos doesn't, right? Cosmos just does everything.
And the high level things, I think what makes Cosmos a bit unique, like number one is the automatic indexing, but number two is actually our partitioning and replication. So for very large scale graphs, we also have some large scale properties here. I mean, as you can imagine, some of our first party services around Skype and LinkedIn are quite large. That's what you want to do is you actually want to spread that workload across a number of machines rather than running it on a single machine. At the end of the day, like if you scale a single machine, you're bounded by whatever latest generation of CPU and memory you can actually throw at that hardware. But as you scale out to a number of machines, what you can do is you can actually build this concept of a partitioned graph. And so the things you want to think about when you're designing a graph on Cosmos DB are actually how you want to then partition the graph to spread that workload across a cluster of machines. We can dynamically scale up and down this cluster for you. We'll take care of all the partition management. All the user actually has to do is tell us a hint on how to distribute the data. And then from here, you can actually support very, very large graphs, do traversals across vertices spread across many machines. What we do is our graph query engine is actually on an abstracted layer above all of the different partitioned pieces of data. And this allows you basically to just have like an infinitely sized graph. The other thing that of course is interesting is, I mean, it is a fully managed service. So as you build something of this scale, as you can imagine, managing clusters of machines is non-trivial. Managing the availability, the updates, these kind of things, of course, we will take care of all of that for you. So you can focus more on, you know, solving cool problems as opposed to babysitting your infrastructure.
No, Andrew, go ahead, Gail.
No, I was going to say, Andrew, like from a developer's perspective, so putting your developer hat on, like you've talked a lot about how this is a pretty turnkey service, very easy to use, scales like crazy. It's awesome. So, and it has kind of a standard around the query language and those kind of things. So as a developer sitting down to use this, a couple questions. One is there like an SDK or a tool set that's kind of preferred to start working with this? Do we have something out there? And then also, like, how do I do development on a plane, you know, where I'm in a disconnected scenario? Is it always I have to be connected to a larger, like the cloud, to do this? Or can I do some stuff even like just on my local machine as I'm starting to hack away and build things?
Yeah. So one of the cool things about for SDK support, we actually built all of our Tinkerpop and Gremlin layer by understanding Tinkerpop at a wire level protocol, meaning we actually just implemented all of this on the server side. And so that way we can actually support any standard Gremlin library. So you can pick and choose your choice of open source Gremlin drivers, change the connection string to point it to Cosmos DB, and that would be your path for starting to build a graph on Cosmos DB. From here, if you wanted to do offline developments, let's say you're sitting on an airplane, we also do support a local emulator. Right now we are still working on introducing graph support for the local emulator, but with that, that'll open up the door of doing offline development should you be more of, let's say, the traveling, you know, developer.
Cool. Awesome.
Just a question about you, because you're talking about the size and the scale of these databases. So how do I get data in there in the first place? Is there kind of like a bulk import of some sort, or do I have to build the graph up step by step by running Gremlin queries against it?
So today we just support the Gremlin commands for adding vertices and adding edges. But pretty soon we're actually trying to make this a bit easier, where we'll also introduce a bulk import library. So that way you're not having this, you know, fire off a bunch of parallelized Gremlin requests yourself. We'll make this a bit easier.
Sorry, CJ.
No problem. Yeah, I was going to say, in the traditional doc database, DocumentDB, we have the concept of an account, a database, and then collections underneath that. How does that contrast with, say, a graph database?
So the resource model will actually look very similar across all the different APIs in Cosmos DB. At the high level, you have an account. This is just like a URI and a set of keys for connecting your app to your database. Underneath that, we have a set of databases. This is really more of a logical abstraction of organizing your underneath containers. I think containers are where things get interesting. Based off of the different data models that we support and the different APIs, we just project that container into different things based off of what the common terminology is. And in a document-oriented data model, people typically call this a collection. In a graph data model, you typically call this a graph. And so same thing as how you would create a collection with a document-oriented data model, you would create a graph in Cosmos DB under your database. You'd set a partition key. You'd set the amount of throughputs, the amount of compute units you want to configure that graph for, and then you can just start hammering away, you know, start adding your vertices and edges. Think of those as your individual records, and then start running queries across those.
Okay. And I know you said this is schema-free, but I have to imagine that as a developer, you have to sort of envision what your graph is going to look like, right, at some point. And so how does one, like, did you, like, recommend just drawing it out somewhere and then, translating that into GraphDB schema?
I'd like to also clarify the term schema-free, because I think it's often misused. I mean, truth be told, if you don't know your schema, you actually don't know how to query over your data. What schema-free really means in this context is reducing the friction between having to have a rigid schema applied to all of your records and having a very homogeneous record set. So think of it this way. Traditionally, you have two things that dictate your schema. One is the data model and the application. The other is the data model and the database. And you also do this crazy deployment dance that whenever you want to add a property, you quickly change the data model and the application, as well as you run a bunch of scripts that might do something like alter tables, create index, etc. But the thing is that if you have a bunch of different records where the properties they evolve quite a bit, imagine like the supply chain scenario where you have a set of devices. Each generation of device actually has a very different set of components and features. And it makes no sense to make this all of these devices homogeneous. It's really crazy to say, like, you know what, all devices must have the exact same schema. And as I create a new generation device, let's say I have the latest generation of smartphone, which might have new fingerprint sensors, NFC radios, Bluetooth, and saying, you know what, I need to apply all of these properties for all of my older phones. So that old Nokia brick phone or that Motorola Razr, you start saying, yeah, what's the NFC radio and fingerprint sensor type on this thing? Or what kind of biometrics do I have on my old Motorola Razr 3? Mm-hmm. That doesn't really make sense, and it doesn't really applied to the real world, data tends to be a little bit more heterogeneous than that. And so the Cosmos DB approach is the database, as long as it's has a valid set of attributes and values, and it can understand it, it'll just take it in and index it by virtue of building this inverted index, and it'll ingest it. And so what you're really doing is you're bringing schema to the record level, and the database is very flexible. The application will dictate what the schema actually looks like. It still needs to be aware of what it's doing from a data model perspective to be able to query over its data. But at the same time, you've reduced a lot of the friction in that within the database, the records can actually have different annotations. They can evolve independently of without having to apply the same blanket rules across all of the other records. And you just get this high degree of flexibility here.
Okay, that makes it a lot clearer. And it does, I suppose it does catch any cyclical loops and things like that?
Yeah. I mean, at the same time, you do want to be aware of, as you're building the your graph query, your application should also be aware of some of these artifacts as well.
Okay. What I found quite nice about the whole graph model, CJ, because I've been looking at it from the point of view of a relational database designer, you go away and model stuff, and then you figure out what the foreign keys and stuff are between your tables and how you lay out your objects. With graph, you go up to the whiteboard, you draw your objects and the relationships between them, and you're done. That's kind of it. That's how it's going to be when it goes into the database. So it's nice to see those relationships, but you don't have to do any kind of modeling. So I spent a while looking for modeling tools and stuff, and right. They are basically is drawing tools. That's it. They might do some clever stuff in terms of turning it into, is it called CypherSpec or something, Andrew?
Some, There are various tooling out there, but for now, we've made a big bet on the Tinkerpop ecosystem, and you would want to look at the tools that work well in that ecosystem.
Okay. One other thing that I've found, so I've been using the .NET SDK, doing some C# stuff with it, and there's pretty much one API that allows you to execute a Gremlin query. It seems to just be text-based, so you just build up text and format strings and stuff, and you're away. Is there any kind of way of doing bind parameters or anything like that, or is that something that's coming?
Not that I'm aware of. I haven't seen a. I guess you're alluding kind of like a link equivalent for Gremlin.
Well, no, not so much the ORM side of it, but more from binding the variables into or the parameters into the query, so I can protect against script injection attacks and stuff like that.
Right. I'm not aware of what each individual driver supports today. I imagine different drivers actually have a different amount of things like string sanitation built into the driver itself before it passes the query over the wire. But at least for now, this is really up to the client.
Okay, makes sense.
Great. Hey, Andrew, I had a question. So this whole graph concept is really new to me. So if I were to design a new application, how would I know that GraphDB is the way to go instead of other types of relational databases?
At a high level, I think problems, this is kind of a little bit more broad than just graph. The way I like to think about it is actually, I'm going to cheat here. I like to think about it from how Gartner actually codified big data systems a while back. And they basically highlighted three different problems or themes. And that would be volume, velocity, and variety. Volume is all about fitting extremely large amounts of data or extremely high number of concurrent requests. And in order to support this, typically the way you would do this is you would partition your database across a cluster of machines. People like to call this, sharding, right? And there's two ways of sharding a system. You either give someone tooling and say, you know what, spin up a ton of different instances, and then here's a bunch of tooling for managing and scaling up, let's say, and down the number of instances. And it's up to you as a developer then to maintain the availability of your system while you do so. Or what you can do is you can actually natively build a system that abstracts this problem away and says, you know what, a single instance can have any number of machines underneath. So that's how we solve it. If volume is a problem, then this Cosmos DB is something worth investigating. The next is velocity. And so it's great that you have all of this data here in a database. But the next thing you want to think about is, well, for each request, what is the latency of that request? And one of the neat things about Cosmos DB is we've implemented resource governance at an individual request level. I'll kind of explain. So resource governance is really about how do you actually manage the set of physical resources like the CPU, the memory, the I/O. Typically, what most databases do is they rely on the underlying operating system to do this for them. But what we've done is we've actually pushed this into the software stack where each request is source governed independently. And what that means is that we can actually build a stack where you get a lot of performance isolation on per request and make sure that each request actually has a very, very predictable latency. So itself, the database itself is blazing fast. But then what we do is we also replicate the data and bring the data closer to wherever your users are around the globe by virtue of our turnkey global distribution. And then from there, you can also exploit data locality. Very similar to how you might use a CDN for your static content, we've actually solved for a dynamic indexed content with Cosmos DB and our global distribution and consistency models. And the third would be variety. Variety is all about the problem of, well, I have a heterogeneous data set. How do I actually support that? I don't want to actually put a blanket scheme on everything, nor do I want to break things up into these weird funky design patterns of splitting up objects and attributes and values into separate tables and doing cross products across those and then figuring out how do I actually do this for a sharded replicated system. So at a high level, like coming back to this, like if any of your problems around volume, velocity, or variety, if you have any of these kind of problems, then this is where you'll see a lot of tremendous benefits from Cosmos DB.
Awesome. Thank you.
Well, Andrew, I think that's been a great update on Cosmos DB and Graph Database. So any more questions for him before we let him go, guys?
No, this is great, Andrew. Thanks again for coming on and spending time, you know, talking to our listeners about this. It's super, super cool tech, and I think it's obviously the future. There's so much going on in this space, so awesome to have you on to chat about it.
Cool. Yeah, thanks.
Yeah, what I love about Andrew is that he's really passionate about this stuff. I know that I've met him in person, and he can talk forever on this stuff. So that's why it's great to have him on. But appreciate it, Andrew, as always, and hope to have you on sometime again.
Yeah, thanks for hosting.
Right. Yeah, really useful. Thank you.
Bye. Thank you.
Thank you for listening to the show. If you have any comments or questions, please use our Twitter handle at Azure Podcasts. Background music has been taken from ccmixter.org under the Creative Commons license. Thank you, and see you next time.